This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. This week's episode was recorded on May 8th, 2016. On this week's show, John and Nick join me, Mike Rappin, to talk about Free Comic Book Day for a moment, and about creators we love to follow. If you have some Free Comic Book Day pictures from this past weekend, send them our way on Twitter at IRCBpodcast, and I'll buy you a comic of your choice on Comixology. And now, this week's episode. This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. I am your host, Mike Rappin, and with me this week are two amazing people of whom I love to talk about comic books with, John Francois.
Hi.
And Nick White.
Hey.
Thank you guys for joining me this week. I'm so excited to talk about Free Comic Book Day because that was yesterday as of this recording on Sunday, and I don't know about you guys, but I went out to Midtown Comics, you know, later in the day for the free comic book stuff, hoping that I could get my hands on at least one or two copies of free comics. And unfortunately, I walked in and they were still giving them away. And by the time I walked out, like with the books that I was going to buy on top of the free books, they were sold out. So I came at the worst time during the day. Did you guys go out and do anything for Free Comic Book Day this week?
Yeah. As per usual, Jordan and I went to Grand Rapids and we went to our comic book store and picked up some of the books. I got the Valiant one, I got the Dark Horse one for adults. That makes it sound kind of edgier than it was, but Dark Horse puts out a kid's book and an adult's book with every Free Comic Book Day, which is a really good policy. Oh, okay. I think that's a fantastic way of doing things.
Is it like an anthology or something of just like little short stories?
It's a sampler, and I didn't get a really good chance to look at it yet, but I think I'd have to look at it again, but I think it might actually be bite-sized standalone stories, not unlike when DC released those like 8-page samples before the DCU came out, and those stories were like completely unique. So that was like a Firefly, Hellblazer, Aliens combination issue, so that was really good. Got the Bongo Comics one, then we went to Vault of Midnight, which, as per usual, pretty long line, probably waited in line for about half an hour. So it wasn't that bad. They, you know, every year they tend to have things under decent control. I think they didn't overload the shop this year as much as they did last year, where it was like really, 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 really packed.
Well, if I remember correctly, last year, maybe I wasn't there for Free Comic Book Day last year, but 2 years ago, I remember at Vault of Midnight in Grand Rapids, they had like a line that was like wrapped around every single single like bookshelf that they had. You basically couldn't look at any of the other books because everyone was just waiting in line to get free comics or buy the stuff that they were there to pick up, as well as get free comics. So it's good to hear that they at least, you know, organized it a little better this year.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there was a line along the, you know, the side of the shop when you walked in, but the line, you know, stopped once you picked up your free book. So they effectively allowed themselves to actually do more business this year, as opposed to just sort of corralling everybody, you know, weaving in and out of each row. So that was nice. And for people that, you know, were waiting to meet up with a friend or hang out or discuss books, it was an easier way of doing things. So yeah, we met up with Kate from the podcast and a friend of hers. I think his name is Josh. I'm so bad with names, but it was good. It was a nice experience. I think they were running a couple other sales, but nothing I really paid that much attention to. But it was a lot better organized this year. I was a bit more impressed with that.
Cool. John, did you do anything for Free Comic Book Day this year?
I did not. That's
all right.
I missed it because I had the memory of last year's Vault of Midnight in my mind. It wasn't bad. It was just messy. Gotcha. And it wasn't as messy as, from the sounds of it, 2 years ago when they had people wrapped around every single shelf. But I just remember standing in line and I got up there and the comics that I was interested in looking at for free comics weren't, I don't think they were there or nothing really jumped out to me as something that I had to have or try out.
Right.
It didn't help that this week I didn't have anything to pick up, so I didn't have a great amount of motivation to make it down there. Yeah, exactly.
Gotcha. I was going to say, what I saw last year, or I should say, what I saw this weekend was a friend of the show, Anna, who used to write for Destroy the Cyborg. She took a bunch of pictures. They did like a huge cosplay thing, so her and her boyfriend dressed up, and I think there was a bunch of people there, but I mean, I only saw some pictures, so I'm not really sure if that was still going on when you were there, Nick, or what.
Yeah, but what were they dressed up as? They were actually judging the adult costume contest.
Oh,
I say adult as if it sounds edgy, but it's just because there was also a children's costume contest.
Gotcha.
Okay. No, they actually had a bunch of booths along, like right alongside the street, not in it, mind you, but like right alongside it. And they had like one that was like making buttons, and another, and these are by different groups. I should mention that they weren't all like directly vault related. Another one was like a sort of like a video game club or something. Who knows? Maybe I've got this completely wrong, but they were playing Mario Kart.
Oh man,
which was really good because like all of these things were, I think, inevitably distracting people and pulling them out of line, which of course benefited me. So, because you know me, I'm hardcore. I'm only there for the comics. None of this, you know, other stuff. I'm focused. I'm focused.
Yeah.
I'm kidding. I really wanted to play Super Contra, but Jordan told me we couldn't. So. And then the girl behind us in line looked at it, and she's like, "Video games used to look like that," to her dad. And I was I was like, "Oh man, one of these.
Oh no,
oh no."
And Nick turns around
like
and
pixel
goes,
art.
"Well, excuse me, let me tell you a thing or two here."
Yeah, listen, lady, we used to have one D-pad and two buttons, and we liked it.
And we didn't know any better back then.
Yeah.
And yes, we did occasionally take the NES zapper and point it at our friends, and that was maybe irresponsible and possibly perpetuated a violent culture, but we did it. We did it.
Oh,
and I'm
man.
Just anyone who's like, Nick White thinks video games and violence are related, whatever. No. Okay.
Oh, my
God. No,
goodness.
It'll fucking kill you if you say that.
Yeah, that's what you think. Oh, boy.
Yeah. The one thing that I almost did yesterday, though, because I felt like being an irresponsible human being was since I was, you know, browsing Twitter and stuff like that. I don't know if you follow our Twitter account, you'll see that we were tweeting about Free Comic Book Day all day yesterday. If you have pictures of your Free Comic Book Day hauls and you want to send us a picture, I will probably send you a free digital comic of your choice. So just, you know, send us a tweet at IRCB Podcast on Twitter. But, you know, there's my plug. But I did see that Scott Snyder was at a New York-based comic shop further up north in New York.
I figured he was. He usually is.
So there were pictures, and I looked it up on Google Maps, and I was like, how would I get there? Like, how close is this to where I'm actually at? And if all I would have had to do was pay like a $25 ticket to go north in New York and then walk like 3 blocks, and I could have gone to that shop. And I seriously considered that as I was walking around Manhattan after going to Midtown Comics. I was like, I could just ditch my friends. And I could just get on a train and go north for an hour and a half and potentially see Scott Snyder. Like, I didn't have any comics for him to sign. I would have just gone there and been like, here, can you just sign this blank piece of paper that I have?
Can you sign this Star-Lord issue, please?
Yeah. I would have probably bought something and just been like, sign this, please. You're the best. Because Scott Snyder is fantastic.
But, he's like, oh, yeah, Mike, what's your favorite issue of my current New 52 run?
Oh, I really liked your Batman number one that I've read twice.
The one where Batman fought that guy who was bad. It was in Gotham.
Yeah.
It was in Gotham, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you guys at least, you know, you have experience with Free Comic Book Day. I'm sorry you didn't go, John, but maybe there's always next year, you know, every year, free comic books.
It's true.
But anyways, let's actually talk about what we read in the past week. So, John, do you want to talk about what you read the last week or two?
Absolutely. I will talk about what I read just before the show.
Yeah, okay.
So I've been sort of putting off comics for no reason in particular other than I just have other things to do. I buy them, I go home, and I think, oh, I'll do X, Y, and Z, and I'll come back and read the comics, and they end up making a nice little pile in the basement that collects dust. So I recently decided to drop a bunch of them, all but two, in fact, those being Invincible and Saga. And that's what I read today. I read Invincible number 124 to 126 and Saga 31 through 35. I'm actually only halfway through 35, so I don't know what the end of the book is like.
Okay.
And Invincible is... I went into it thinking that I was going to hate it and I was going to drop the series because they were doing...
The reboot thing.
Yeah, time travel or whatever. And that is a surefire way to usually... just piss me right off and mm-hmm. make me not really enjoy it. But the way that it was handled was a lot of fun, actually. And I found myself like very quickly sort of breaking through that already like built up grudge exterior of like, this is stupid, I'm going to hate it, but whatever.
Pleasantly surprised.
Yeah,
that was the like... least found emotion on this podcast.
And so that was what I was doing for a while before the podcast, and I think I'm missing the most recent issue.
Yeah, yeah.
So I need to pick that up.
I think one of my most favorite things about that book is that it's so far down the road, you know, from where it started, and not in like it's gotten bad, but just it's been around for so long that Comixology had like a sale a while ago on that book, and it was like all of the trades are only like $4 or whatever, and I was like, wow, that's a great deal. And then I like kept scrolling as it's like, here's another page of trades, here's another page of trades, here's another page of trades. Then I was like, okay, that's like 20, like 8 times like 4. That's still a lot of money. That's yeah. still a ton of money.
Well,
I guess I'll never read this book.
I mean, yeah, if you're trying to read all of Invincible, like you pretty much have to bite the bullet and buy those 50 issue compendiums that they have,
or the omnibuses
that they have. Yeah, I actually,
if you want to go physical, yeah,
yeah.
Sure.
And I know that I think Comixology sell
which
those,
is a nightmare.
But like,
you want to lug
still,
that around?
Yeah, that's the thing. It's if you want something like that, it looks nice on your shelf, but you're not going to carry that. I mean, speaking of that, when I was at Midtown, I saw the giant Doom Grant Morrison's Doom Patrol omnibus. That thing is
ooh.
Thicker than my head almost in terms of width. Like it's a monstrous book. There's no way that that's even easy to read unless you had like a podium, like you would have at like a church or at like a library,
like a lectern.
Yeah,
it's a lectern.
And you have
yeah,
to like
yeah, yeah.
sit it down, and you'd have to stand to read it because there's no other way you could actually comfortably hold this book. It's just it's humongous. But anyway, sorry,
like
John.
Those, yeah. Like those leg supports that like Bruce Wayne has in Dark Knight Rises. Like you just have one of those built for your wrist to like help you yeah. augment, you know, carry this book around.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's actually just a dual purpose exercise in reading and core strength.
Yeah,
yeah.
Through like, comic
what are you
books,
doing?
You can get
burning
hit.
Calories, reading comics, okay. not being respected.
Yeah. So Nick, what did you read this week? I'm sorry. What did you read this week, Nick? Please get to just go to that.
Yeah, sure. I read a lot, actually. I had quite a bit of time and quite a few books that I was like, you know what, this has just got to get read at some point, really. So I read Justice League Volume 6 in Justice League. That's the wonderful title they went with, which is actually two arcs together. It's the... I don't really what you want to call the first one, the Power Ring arc, which sort of follows the new owner of Power Ring's ring, who died at the end of Forever Evil. Spoilers,
okay,
but not really, because that was a while ago.
Yeah.
I don't feel bad about sharing that. And it's also the Amazo virus arc, which has Jason Fabok on art.
Yeah,
and it was a lot of fun. Geoff Johns does a lot of just really fun, really goofy. World, you know, the world is in danger stakes all the time. But I think a lot of people don't give him credit that he actually is willing on occasion to delve into some of the more obscure parts of the DC universe. I think a lot of people see him, and unfortunately with DC Rebirth, you're getting this perspective a lot that, you know, Geoff Johns thinks that the DC universe is populated by maybe 15 characters, 13 of which are men, and that there's no one else that's going to make money, and he doesn't care. And that's just not true. He actually brought the Doom Patrol into the mainstream Justice League book, and it was obviously weird and different, but it was much more approachable than I think other takes on the Doom Patrol have been, even though they kind of sort of come off as asshats, but mm-hmm. Whatever. And beyond that, it was just, you know what, I would love... You know, Jordan and I used to make fun of the Shazam book by Geoff Johns because we're like, who wants to read just a Shazam book? But then in this arc, like the way he writes Shazam, because you know Shazam is obviously just a transformed like kid.
Hold on. I don't actually know the full backstory.
What, of Shazam?
Yeah, like isn't the character? It's essentially Billy Batson. And he
right.
like, gets powers from a wizard, and when he says the magic word, he turns into formerly Captain Marvel, but now Shazam, right?
You got it. You
okay.
got it.
That's okay, right. There we go.
Now, obviously, there are different versions of that where, like, Shazam is actually multiple kids that yeah. transform together in a firestorm-esque kind of way, but whatever. Who cares about that? So it's so hilarious because he just basically writes him like a kid, so it's more or less like a child is running around with the Justice League, and he's like up at the Justice League watchtower, and he's just talking to Cyborg, and he's like, I'm bored. I just want to play Xbox. And Cyborg is like, I've actually got an Xbox in my arm. And Shazam's like, oh, really? For real? That's awesome. No way. And at like another point, the Justice League is like, all right, we've tried like brute strength, we've tried like lasers, and that's pretty much the extent of powers that the Justice League has. I'm kidding. Mm-hmm. They're like, we need a new alternative to get this whatever resource. And they're like, Shazam, could you use magic? And he's like, with the power of Shazam, help me get the Justice League what they really want. And then just a Shazam emblazoned ping pong table shows up because he's been talking about how much he really wants to play ping pong. I'm serious. And he's like, all right, let's play. So him and Cyborg play ping pong. It's it was goofy. I really liked it.
Sounds like it's, the Justice Bros. I like it.
It was great. Beyond that, I read a whole bunch of other things that I'm going to more or less just sort of just go over as briefly as possible. Tokyo Ghost does deserve a little bit of extra time simply to say, really, really disappointed with this book. I realized that for some people, I think James included, they actually really enjoyed it. But for me, I've never really loved Rick Remender. It's really hilarious how many Rick Remender books I read just because for some odd reason he manages to pair himself with artists that I really, really love. Mm-hmm. And this whole following creators thing, we'll touch on this later. But with artists, with writers, if you don't like a book they're writing, they're probably writing multiple books. You can bounce onto other books. With artists, they're only, for the most part, drawing one book at a time. And right. so sometimes you have to make bigger compromises and put up with writers maybe you don't like. And Sean Murphy is a great artist. Matt Hollingsworth is an amazing colorist. They're both great. The artwork for this book is pretty good, even if I think the design work is maybe not the best. But, of course, I think that's more Remender-influenced. But this book is just another, you know, buyer beware of, you know, conspicuous, consumption. And look out, social media is going to make us into slobs. So in that sense, it's basically just Wall-E. And then this idea that, you know, media is just going to be something we're jacked into all the time, nonstop. And so in that sense, it's basically Transmetropolitan, except you can't out-Disney-Disney, and you can't out Warren Ellis. So right. you're just going to fail in both respects. So just sort of a disappointment with this whole Orientalist idea that, like, oh, Western culture, you know, is going to create turmoil in your soul, and the only way to be at peace is to adapt this tranquil, undisturbed, you know, Eastern culture where they've figured out what Zen is. Anyway, it did not like it. It was not a fan. Beyond that, just a few other quick things worth mentioning. I read Godzilla Oblivion by Joshua Hale Fialkov. I think I got that right. I hope I got that right. I mean,
yes.
We have no reason to be getting that wrong.
For the millionth time on this show, Nick, I think you've got
it. Yeah. Ninjak 14. And the other thing I would just really, really say real fast is Flash Gordon number one was on sale. The whole Flash Gordon, Doc Shaner, Jeff Parker, Jordy Belair title. And boy, is that book bright, clean lines, lots of fun. Old school, not too serious, really enjoyed it. That's what I read.
Cool. Well, I was saying this before we started recording, but I sat down in the last 2 days and I think I read close to 35 comics because I've just been sitting on so many. And I've been slowly reading books throughout the week. Like, I've been trying to read at least one or two digital books a week. So I had a plethora of books to pick from. Specifically on Wednesday, I sat down and I was determined to just read as many books as I could after I went to the comic shop and picked up my books for that week. So, but of the probably, like I said, probably around 35 that I read, I did manage to pick five that I wanted to just mention and one to talk about a little bit more. I read Mayflower number one, which is a Comixology submit book by someone named Levi Hoffmeyer. That book is the coolest sci-fi, like independent sci-fi story that I don't really understand in a good way. Like they tease you with so many pieces of this new dystopian sci-fi world that I was like, oh my God, I need more of this. And then I found out that this first issue, it was on sale or something. So I grabbed it and it came out in 2014. And the first issue came out in, I think, March or April of 2014. The second issue came out in December of 2014, and issue 3 just came out on April 20th of this year. So maybe don't get invested in this book, but I'm definitely willing to try, you know, the other two issues, especially because they're only coming out at $1.99 an issue, and I think that's a killer price for a really beautiful book. Like, the art on this book is absolutely fantastic, and it's one of those things where when you see a one-man band kind of book, sometimes either the art struggles or maybe the writing struggles, but this book was incredibly solid. So for $1.99 an issue, that's totally worth it. I read Renato Jones, The 1% Number One, which is a new book by Cary Kyle Andrews. He's the same guy that did The Immortal Iron Fist, The Living Weapon, which is a Marvel book that came out a little while ago. The Cary Kyle Andrews' art and is like the most raw, high energy, crazy, action-packed style that I've ever seen, and his writing is kind of all over the place in this book, and in fact this whole book is all over the place and it's fucked up and weird, and I wouldn't recommend it to everyone, but if you're looking for some really high energy, like fuck the man, not damn the man, fuck the man, I'm gonna kill everyone style Punisher Batman story about a dude who's just like, I'm gonna kill all these one percenters, it's a crazy, awesome book. But otherwise, it might be a little bit out there for some people, so I wouldn't recommend it. But if you're looking, like I said, for killing and action and demented politics, this is a good one. I read Punisher Number One by Becky Cloonan and Steve Dillon, and I was really hesitant about this book because I don't really care for Steve Dillon's art. But from page 2, I was sold on the story. So I pushed through the rest of it. I'm subscribed to this book. I'm going to be buying it until Becky Cloonan's off of it, because her writing for The Punisher was just perfect. Like, if you watched Daredevil Season 2 and you liked how The Punisher was portrayed, this is the comic book for you. I highly recommend it. And I read All New Wolverine Number 7, which featured Squirrel Girl for an issue, which I wasn't really too keen on because I'm not a big fan of Squirrel Girl, but it turns out that her being in the issue was like the most fun I've had in an X-Men comic book in a very long time. And like, specifically because, and this is a minor spoiler, Squirrel Girl shows up at X-23, aka Wolverine's house, with a Wolverine, an actual physical living Wolverine, and says, hey, you can talk to these, right? And oh my God. I burst out laughing at like 1 in the morning when I was reading this. And yeah, so I can't recommend All New Wolverine enough. There's a lot of feels in this book, and I don't really say that too often, but there was a lot of good feelings that came out of it. I love this book. I will continue reading it until it is more than likely canceled, but this is such a great book. But finally, I read Department H Number 1 by Matt Kent and Charlene Kent, his wife, and these two are a power couple. This book is beautiful, and I cannot recommend this book enough. If you like anything that Matkin has ever done, I think this is going to be one of his best independent series ever. The Number One sold me in so many ways. The art is beautiful. The story is really well crafted. It's a wonderful mystery story. It makes me feel ashamed that I haven't read all of his other independent stuff, because if this Number One is that good, I have to imagine that everything else he's done has been at least as good, you know, in their completed state. So buy this book as well. I can't recommend, all these books are pretty good. I mean, you know, I'm only talking about good stuff this week. So John, if you're looking for comic books to read, there's like 4 of them at least.
That Punisher book, those are Cloonan covers as well, right?
Issue was Declan Shalvey.
Oh, was it really?
Yeah, the one with the skull at least.
Yeah, that's... okay. All right. For some weird reason, I thought that... I would have never guessed that was a Declan Shalvey cover. It looked too neat.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm pretty sure... Yeah, it's signed Declan in the bottom left-hand corner. So, yeah, that's definitely him.
But what's Steve Dillon done in terms of art? Because I didn't bother to flip through it, but...
Steve Dillon...
The name clicked, but...
He did the you know, infamous Garth Ennis run. He did all the art on that book. He did... I'm trying to think of stuff that I've read, but Ultimate Avengers Volume 3 with Mark Miller.
Okay.
That's kind of a weird one. He's done a lot of Marvel work, and his art is very distinctive. Like, it's very rough, and a lot of the people look the same, which is unfortunate. But when he draws the Punisher, you know it's the Punisher. Like, all the faces look very similar, but the Punisher's face is unique every time. It's fantastic.
Huh. Yeah. I always find it kind of weird how it seems like every time there's a Punisher run, the book always tends to look like hyper real or like really like.
They go for world-ish. Super gritty. I mean, they want you to feel the raw violence that is that book. And Steve Dillon's art absolutely captures that. That's why his run with Garth Ennis was so successful, because the guy, you know, they those two guys together, they know nitty gritty nasty violence. And one thing I can say is, you know, there isn't a lot of demented, like, fucked up stuff, I guess, as much as it was in the Garth Ennis run. I don't know if you guys remember a couple episodes back, Tia was talking about how she read some of that book, and she wasn't too pleased with it. And I think part of that is because of how, was probably partially, mostly because of the story, but also the art just adds more grittiness and roughness to the things. So, I don't know.
Okay.
But let's move on to our comic picks for this week, and maybe we'll wrap these up a little bit quicker because I talked for a really long time, so sorry. But Nick...
Well, not just you, but yeah.
What are you excited for this upcoming week?
For me, it's Ninjak number 15. That's Matt Kint writing, and that's Diego Bernard on art. Well, for the main art, and then it's Koi. I don't know how you say that. K-H-O-I.
It's Koi Fam.
P-H-A-M. Yeah. I'm probably butchering all of it.
No, maybe you got it right.
Okay. On the backup art. This book continues to be a 40-page issue every single month. They have not backed off that. We are on number 15 now, and they are holding strong to that. I really like this new arc. This will be the second issue of the arc, the siege of King's Castle. Which is kind of pulling an incident not unlike what we saw with Lemire's run of Green Arrow. Minor spoilers here. King's Castle is Colin King, who is Ninjak. That's his place. And it gets completely blown up, and he barely survives. And he goes out into the world to try to go to one of his, what do they call those, like a safe house? Wherever, like, you know, you keep your backup supplies, yeah, you know, scattered around the city and everything. Yeah, he goes to one of his safe houses only to discover that, like, someone has raided all of his safe houses. Someone has wiped his files from Interpol. But on top of that, they've gone in and basically made him, like, one of the top 10 criminals in their database. They've removed all of his finances. Like I said, identity theft. It like, everything. And so it's really neat because he actually runs into Livewire, who I don't know if they've ever overtly said this, but I think him and Livewire were a thing, it's intimated that they were a thing at one point.
Gotcha.
It's never like blatant. And she gives him this like really weird kind of like contact lens, and like scans it and puts him in this weird database, and then all of a sudden she's like, you know, I'm pulling pennies off of all of these huge multi, you know, national accounts, and she's like, you've now got enough money. She's like, I've now, you know, with your iris scan, I've put a temporary identity into the database for you, which won't hold under scrutiny, but it's a good start. It was kind of a really cool espionage meetup sort of thing, and now he's trying to figure out who's done this to him. Although it's suggested it's Roku, who maybe you remember is that one lady with the really long, razor-sharp red hair that, like, you know, kills people via hair. Killing via hair. That's what happens.
Okay.
And the backup story, still really enjoyable. I really like what they're doing with that. It's actually following Colin King's parents, who were also spies. And so it's very odd to have an issue about Colin King and then at the end have a backup story that ends with his mother telling his dad that she wants to have a kid. So it ends with the quote-unquote beginning of Colin King himself, I guess you could say. Really interesting story. I like Diego Bernard's art. He was on Exo Man of War for a decent while, I believe. So really enjoyable. I think this is a clean break from the arc that was in the Shadowlands or the Shadow Realm, which admittedly I wasn't crazy about. But so that's me.
Cool. John, are you reading anything this week? I know you said you dropped your books down to two.
Yeah, and I don't believe either of them are coming out this week. Oh, so I don't have a pick in particular, although I might finally give in to Xander's recommendations and buy some of Skullkickers and read that on Comixology.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I can't recommend that enough. I mean, Xander was the one that told me about that book in the first place, and oh man, I read the first volume in a sitting. Like, I literally just could not stop reading because it was that good. So I think if you get hooked, you're going to get hooked hard, man.
Yeah, and there's a lot out there, and I don't want to have to buy all that at once.
Exactly. And I mean, what's really nice is that usually Comixology does some killer sales on that book. I think I've got each of those volumes for like $3 or $4 each. Like, and that's, you know, six to eight issues depending on the arc. So, you know, keep an eye out.
Yeah. They do bundles. I think I landed all of it for $28 once with a huge bundle.
Nice.
So,
nice.
I just love how self-aware that book is. It's just so wonderfully so great.
Cool.
So I assume there's some sort of joke because they have an issue 100 which appears just after issue 33.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, this Jim Zub, and if you've read any of his articles, like he has a very approachable he's very good at like describing all of the ridiculousness of the comic book industry and sort of the ins and outs of it, and you get a lot of that in Skullkickers, and that's what I love about it. He's like he starts randomly retitling a bunch of the issues like Mighty Skullkickers or like All Different Skullkickers or whatever. It's hilarious.
Cool. Yeah. Well, for me this week, I only have two books on my pull list, which is really surprising seeing that I tallied up all of my pulls and it's way more than I thought it was, but the last two or three weeks have been really big, so I guess it's nice to have a small week so I can catch up on more stuff. But this week my pick is Constantine the Hellblazer number 12. I don't think I need to try to sell this book to anyone anymore. If you haven't heard me talk about it, listen to the last, like, you know, 8 or 9 episodes of this show. I know that we've talked about it at least 4 or 5 times, even though there's only been like 3 or 4 issues in the last couple of months. But this book is fantastic. I'm really, really excited to see how they wrap this up before Rebirth, and we're getting closer to a major, I guess, almost like fighting point between Constantine and Neuron, the like super villain in this most recent arc. So, you know, New York City has gone crazy, and Constantine's the only one that can save it. And I like those kinds of stories sometimes because Constantine, he doesn't even want to do it. He's like, I'm done. I'm
exactly.
I quit. I'm not going to be Constantine anymore. I'm just going to be a guy. And everyone's like, but you're the only one that can help. So it's a good book. It's fantastic. And I don't remember who's the new artist on this book, but whoever's on it, I did like the transition from
Rossmo.
Oh yeah, Riley Rossmo. Thank you to this new artist. It's been a good.
Wasn't Travel Foreman doing 1 or 2 issues? Is it still Foreman?
It might have been Travel Foreman. Yeah, but it's been good. Okay. Like the from one artist to the next, it wasn't so jarring that I was like, holy cow! I had to like go back and actually look it up. It worked really well. So it's going to be a good book.
So before, I mentioned Tokyo Ghost and how I read it despite the fact that I'm not the craziest fan of Rick Remender. In fact, that would probably be the most polite way of putting it. But I read it because Sean Murphy was doing the art, who is amazing, and Matt Hollingsworth is doing the colors, who is equally amazing. And so I put up with the fact that I knew I probably would hate the narrative and just stare at the art and avoid the word bubbles because of that. But it got me thinking about the whole idea of there are people out there that we follow unconditionally or close to unconditionally because we have this allegiance to them. And I think it's true of all of us. I think we all have artists, colorists, even maybe a letterer, no offense letterers, but I mean, there are a few I follow that we really, really enjoy. And when we see their name in the credits or the solicits of a book, it catches our eye and we go, well, geez, I think I'm definitely going to pick that up, even if there are other things that we have misgivings about. And so this week, we're going to talk about those sorts of creators for us that sort of elicit that feeling in us, that we want to go out and find their books and buy them almost unconditionally. And so tell me what some of these people are for you guys, or who these people are for you guys. The 5 W's, I've got them all down. go ahead, guys.
I mean, I've been thinking about this topic, you know, since we kind of planned out the show and we've been, you know, we talked about it a little bit, but I've been thinking about it, and there's only maybe a handful of writers that I'll follow unconditionally. Like Warren Ellis is one of those creators that, you know, I've talked about a billion times on this show, and I've I've tried to pick up almost everything that he's ever written, simply because I enjoy the way he approaches stories. And it's something that I, even if it's a story that I don't even care for the topic, like I don't really care that much about James Bond, but I'm still reading his James Bond book because I want to see him take that character like in a different direction than what I expect James Bond to be. So I've given the current James Bond story the first arc. I don't know if I'm going to necessarily continue with the second arc, but I want to at least say that I tried, and to say, you know, maybe that wasn't for me, but I could see how someone who likes James Bond might get a kick out of this, because he tried to embody the character in a way that the, you know, the original creator of James Bond would have written a story. So that was interesting for me. I mean, there's a couple of other artists, but I don't want to just keep talking on and on. So I don't know. John, do you have one or two that you want to talk about?
Dan Abnett is the closest that I've ever come to having someone that I follow unconditionally. For a while, I was picking up all of his stuff. He did the Hypernaturals, and he also did, what was that called? It was
Wild's End.
War of the Worlds, except, yeah, Wild's End, thank you. That's what it was. And I was determined to you know, hunt down all of his work and collect and read it, because I really enjoyed his work so far. And he also wrote a bunch of books, not comic book, but actual just books that I really liked, which is how I knew of him in the first place. But then He did some work for Marvel, and I wasn't super interested in the topic, and I realized right then and there that I was not willing to follow him anywhere, because it just didn't sound that interesting. And, you know, maybe he would make a good story, but if I didn't care about the subject matter, I was going to have a really hard time justifying and also then reading the comic, whatever it would be. I forget what it was now, but it didn't strike me, because I don't know what it was.
Right.
Otherwise, I don't think I have anyone else that I'll follow unconditionally. For a while, I was really hard into, you know, Kirkman was the big thing for me, but then I dropped The Walking Dead, so I can't really say that. I'm still reading Invincible, and even through a couple of the rough patches, I'll keep reading that, and I probably will unless I do something really drastic.
Right.
And otherwise, I guess Brian K. Vaughan, but I've only ever read Saga from him, so I can't really say that I would follow him anywhere.
Right.
Because I've only ever read the one thing from him, even though I really, really like it. So I think out of all those, it would be Dan Abnett's the person I'm most likely to follow anywhere, followed by Brian K. Vaughan.
Yeah.
And then I'll just keep reading Invincible from Kirkman.
Have you tried Brian K. Vaughan's Paper Girls?
Yes. Okay, yes. Actually, I have. And I enjoyed that story, but it did not make the culling, I guess is what I'm calling this now, where I dropped everything but
oh,
two.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Got a name.
Because money and other such reasons. Mostly money. It's exclusively money. It didn't survive that. I had to, you know, I had to make some tough calls, and it got dropped. So I liked it, and if I had more money, I'd probably keep reading it. So, yeah, I guess that was another one of his books that I really liked as well.
Gotcha. Well, I mean, you know, you can always pick it up and trade if you happen to come across an extra few bucks.
And I think that's probably what I'll end up doing is trying to hunt down some more of the anthologies or collections that when I have more money.
Yeah. I mean, and if anything, you know, you can always go grab his series Private Eye that he did, that was a digital-only book for a while. And I mean, you can get that online for, I think you can get it for free. Like, you can go to panelsyndicate.com and you can technically not pay for that book. I mean, obviously it's encouraged to at least pay $1 or $3 or whatever you want, but it's a pay what you want for the entire series. I bought every single issue of that book, and then I bought the hardcover because it's one of those books that's so good, like, you want to pay for it twice. But I mean, if you just want to sample it, get number one.
It's one of those books that doesn't fit on your shelf.
Yeah, and it's landscape.
And it costs $50. Yeah.
But I mean, it's beautiful in hardcover. I can't express that enough. But I mean, John, if you're looking for more Brian K. Vaughan, that's what I'd recommend.
Okay.
Nick,
Brian K. Vaughan is one of those weird writers where I think a lot of people have actually read more of him than they think. They just don't remember that it was actually Brian K. Vaughan.
Yeah.
Pre-saga Brian K. Vaughan.
Right. Yeah, but to you, Nick, I have like two or three others, but let's turn to you to see if, you know, just get a sampling of what you've probably got under your sleeve.
Yeah, sure. Scott Snyder is going to come as no surprise to anybody, but Scott Snyder has just been, you know, knocking it out of the park left and right, all the way from Batman the Black Mirror to Sweet Tooth to American Vampire to the current ongoing, or I guess technically his part's done, but the New 52 Batman run. Although it does bear mention that with Scott Snyder, and I think this is one of those interesting points about following creators, Scott Snyder is not, and admittedly so, he's not the most prolific writer. Even he has admitted this, like, he knows that. He's tweeted a lot about how, you know, the writing process for him is not as quick as it is for other people. And so with people like him, I think it's a lot easier to follow them unconditionally, just because they're not just throwing stuff out all of the time. And that's not to say that if you're a Charles Soule or a Dan Abnett and you're hyper prolific that, you know, you're bound to, you know, make stuff that maybe you don't care about. But obviously when you're putting out that much stuff, you know, the quality is going to eventually, something's not going to, you know, go for your readers. So I like him. Jeff Lemire comes as no surprise to anybody, but he's remarkably reliable and bankable for me, although he has made a couple missteps that I, you know, haven't super liked. Justice League United, I honestly think Jeff Parker did a better job with.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to talk about his switch over to Marvel, I'm sitting on his Moon Knight number one, but I haven't read it. But his X-Men, like, that's sort of where I draw the line. Like, for me, like, as we were discussing earlier, where do you draw the line with some of these people? Like, if they switch big two publishers, do you go, okay, you know, you're dead to me? And then Dan Didio is, like, sitting there like Mr. Burns in the corner of the room, you know, wringing his hands, going, this pleases me. Is it a publisher thing? Is it, like, do you like their independent stuff, but you just don't actually really enjoy their big two? Or in the odd case of Rick Remender for me, I actually prefer his big two, or really I should say Marvel. I actually prefer his Marvel stuff over when, you know, they let him go unhinged and do whatever he wants.
Mm-hmm.
Artist-wise, just for a quick sampling, I would say Jock. Jock I'll follow anywhere. At first, I wasn't really crazy about Jock's art. Like, when I first read Black Mirror, I didn't really... Man, I was dumb. So... I'm still dumb, but dumb in different ways,
see,
right?
But, like, Jock's art is... It's so angly. Anyway, I won't...
It is. Yeah. It is. But at the time, I honestly thought, like, Frank Avila and Jock, I thought it was, like, one artist, and I thought, like, the guy was really slacking off when he was doing Jock's issues. Like, I was like... Like, this guy can draw like this, you know, Frank Avila stuff. And then I'm like, and then, like, this happens. Why does this happen? Like, what's going on with this book? Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah, the back and
like
forth
I said,
issues,
I'm still
yeah.
dumb, just in different ways. Yeah. Of course, now I get that it's two different artists. And now I really, really love Jock's art. His art on Witches, his snapshot thing that he did with Andy Diggle, Green Arrow Year One. You're right, it's angular, it's a little loose, it's kind of got a very, I don't want to say like thrown together, but it's very loose, definitely. And it's not for everybody, but Jock would be one artist I really enjoy. People are probably thinking, gee, Nick, can you like throw out a more like obscure name? I already know that you love Jeff Lemire, everybody loves Scott Snyder.
Mm-hmm.
I want another option that's maybe more obscure. Just kidding. No one cares that much. But I would say Travel Foreman. Travel Foreman is not the most prolific guy, but go look up his run on Animal Man with Jeff Lemire.
Yeah.
Some of the creepiest art out there. And also some of the most polarizing art. Like, there are a lot of people that don't like his style. Like, his weird sort of shading. And he's done stuff that isn't horror. Like, he did Birds of Prey for a bit, but it looked weird. Like, he's almost kind of trapped within the horror genre.
Yeah. I mean, but I think his style of art really lends to that. So, like, I don't know if that's so
bad.
Oh,
it does.
You know? Like,
no,
I wouldn't want to
no,
see
not.
Someone like, I don't know. I wouldn't want to see, like, a Scotty Young trying to do a horror book, you know? Like, that just wouldn't work. But
oh,
Travel
God.
Foreman, oh, man. Like, that guy's, it's so... gritty. It's I said gritty a million times earlier, so I'm trying to find another word, but it's just it's very rough.
It's hard to explain his style because it's not like conventional horror. Like, it's real, because like with Animal Man, it was this weird blending of the everyday suburbia family life alongside of insane, like, mutated undead creature rot world stuff.
Yeah,
and yet it all blended into this weird cohesive world. Like I said, he's not the most prolific. He had some family issues going on, I think, when Animal Man was a couple issues in, and so Steve Pugh had to finish. But he came back and he drew the Animal Man Annual number 2, which I don't know if you remember that, with like the sort of like the spider.
Yeah.
Like that dream spider. Yeah. Oh, one of the most beautiful, sad, gut-wrenching issues of all time. And then he showed up for the last issue of Animal Man and did the exact same thing and made everybody cry again. So, Travel Foreman, masterful artist. Recently, he's done a little bit of Constantine the Hellblazer. Amazing, amazing, amazing guy. Not for everybody, I will say that, but
yeah,
just fantastic.
Yeah, that run of Animal Man, still one of my favorite like comics in recent history. It's such a fantastic story. But yeah, I'm trying to think of artists that I would follow. I think that people like Marco Rudy, who's done a lot of work at Marvel. He did a story with Matt Kent, Spider-Man or Marvel Knights Spider-Man, and that was one of the coolest Spider-Man stories I've ever read in 5 issues. Like I'm not a big Spider-Man fan. I read Spider-Man for a while, but I picked that up because it had the Marvel Knight branding. It had Matt Kent on writing, and I was like, I'm sold, because I've always wanted to read more Matt Kent, and this was like right in my wheelhouse of being enough Marvel to where it's right in my knowledge base, and then trying to see an interesting, darker, quote-unquote darker take on Spider-Man. And it wasn't so much that it was darker, but that story was just super experimental with the panel layout and the story, like the way that they told the story was really, really bizarre. And it ended up being like a really, really cool 5-issue mini story. Like if you haven't read that book, I can't recommend that. I can't recommend that enough, because it's so just bizarre. And they cover every single Spider-Man villain you could ever think of. And Peter Parker is just run through the gamut, just having his ass kicked like panel after panel, page after page. It's really cool.
You actually bring up a really good point though, Mike. I think a lot of times we think of this whole independent comics and Big Two comics as almost always being sort of a Big Two. You know, you work for the Big Two until you can make it to do your independent stuff, mm-hmm. or you work for the Big Two until you get big enough where you can do both simultaneously. But when it comes to following creators, a lot of that whole discussion, a lot of it for me, sometimes boils down to when you have someone who's actually really known for doing independent stuff coming to the Big Two, and whether or not you follow them there and what sort of success they have. Because, for example, like Matt Kent, when Matt Kent was put on New 52 Suicide Squad, like, I was already reading it, but that kept me reading it, which was interesting, because that came right on the heels of an Alish Kott run on Suicide Squad, which is one of the weirdest things possible. And it's like I said, it's some of these people, they come in and they're able to sort of meld their tone and their voice and sometimes their ego with what the Big Two demands of them. And I think Matt Kent did a really good job of blending what he wanted to bring to the table with what they wanted. Mm-hmm. Whereas Alish Kott was like, did you guys read Zero? Because like, fuck the rules. Yeah. I'm going to do whatever I want.
Yeah. That was his Bucky Barnes.
Don't expect me to ever pick up the phone when my DC editors call. So, yeah.
I mean, that was his Bucky Barnes run at Marvel that he did, the Bucky Barnes Winter Soldier, which was not even remotely about Bucky being Bucky like you would expect. Instead, it's about, you know, Bucky Barnes being addicted to this drug that made him go crazy with Marco Rudy on art. And since I'm a huge Alish Kott fan now, after reading Zero, it was like the perfect combination of a series. But man, it's like a giant acid trip for 12 issues, I think. Maybe I think it might have been a couple less than that, but yeah, it's a bizarro comic book that Marvel was just like, okay, you can run with this, whatever, we don't care. Like that's ultimately what it felt like. But so speaking of the you know, an independent creator going over to like the Big Two or working on a series that has, you know, a big property behind it, John, have you tried to follow anyone that you would like, you were a big fan of at least at one point into the Big Two? I know you said Dan Abnett, but you didn't read any of the books. But if, you know, Robert Kirkman decided, you know, and this will never happen,
or like Hickman,
or if you know, yeah, John Hickman or, you know, Dan Abnett came back and tried to do another book, would you maybe try a number one, or is that like just completely off the table for you?
It depends on what they're writing, I suppose.
Okay.
There are some heroes that I like more than others. I've never been a big fan of Captain America, for example. But if it was like an Iron Man thing, then sure, I might read that.
Okay.
I like robot tech suit stuff. That's fine.
Okay.
So I guess it would depend mostly on what it was about. Right. I'm not willing to write it off entirely, but chances are good that I would not pick it up. Also, because they just arbitrarily charge you a dollar more.
Yeah, depending on the book, yeah. Especially with an Iron Man or something, you're looking at a potential $5 number one simply because. But,
right.
I mean, would there be like any specific topics? I guess, and this, I guess we're talking specifically about creators, but, you know, like, would you see any, like, I guess I'm trying to phrase this as, like, outside of, like, Iron Man or anything, would there be anything that you'd be willing to try from the big two if they were doing something really unique or if they had, like, a specific artist?
I mean, probably.
Okay. That's kind of a weirdly phrased question.
It's a vague question, yeah. So I can only give you a vague answer. But, I mean, yeah, I wouldn't rule it out, that, if that's what you're asking. Okay. I'm not going to be quite so spiteful as to entirely rule something out just because it's in one of the big two. If it's DC...
Mike's trying to say is, like, are there any, like, current properties in the big two or maybe Marvel specifically that, like, you're just waiting for someone you feel more confident about to get on the book? Is there, like, a character you really enjoy that you feel is just not being done right now?
Because
I know for Marvel forever, it's always been the fact that, like, the Iron Man books, quote-unquote, have never been good or nobody likes them or they're unappealing. And that's why they slammed Brian Michael Bendis on it right now. And they said, all right, guys, Brian Michael Bendis, like, we dare you. We dare you to tell us that this book is, like, out of touch or, you know.
You say that, but I think Brian Michael Bendis is one of those polarizing writers. People don't like him on the internet. I feel like there's a large community of people, or maybe a loud community of people, that really
there's
don't like him.
At least a decent amount, sure.
But... Yeah, I don't know. But the politics of that are ridiculous sometimes to me. So, you know, they're just like, he's too wordy. It's like, well, you're reading a book. Like, slow down, man.
He's writing too many books. Yeah. How is it happening? Someone needs to get to the bottom of this. Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to think of, like, artists that would make me potentially, or even creators that would potentially make me, you know, jump on a book. And, like, Riley Rossimo was the whole reason I'd started Constantine, because of his work on, you know, Rasputin, and I'd seen his work in Bedlam. And so, like, I was totally on board for Constantine, not only because I was slightly interested in Constantine, but Riley Rossimo was, like, the seal that said, okay, at least I got to give this an arc. And boy, oh boy, was it absolutely worth it. Which kind of begs another question. Was there anything that you guys have checked out simply because of a creator that, like, actually surprised you? Like, you followed a writer, you followed an artist, and that led you to meet a new writer or artist that you, like, latched onto and was like, okay, I want to read everything that they've done.
Sure. I mean, with The Valiant, I read that primarily because it was Jeff Lemire and Matt Kent. And at that point, I sort of knew the name Paolo Rivera, and I'd seen some of his pictures here and there on websites, but I certainly wasn't reading anything that he was, you know, working on or any runs. And I read The Valiant, and I absolutely loved his art. And so next thing you know, I hear that he's actually going to be doing Hellboy in the BPRD 1953, and I was like, absolutely, you know, unconditionally, let's give this a try. Which was really saying something, because Hellboy has always struck me as one of those books that is one of those insurmountable things, because people are like, well, you know, all of the arcs are standalone, it doesn't matter what ones you read. Well, guess what, I'm gonna read them in order. I don't care about your anarchistic beliefs. And all those books are like $20, or I have to go to the library, or there's work involved. We'll just say that. It looks like there's a lot of work
potentially
involved.
Yeah.
But when I heard that this new BPRD thing was sort of standalone and it was Rivera, I thought that was really, really promising. And I think Dark Horse has done a fantastic job in that regard of creating this new Hellboy title, where it's less about sort of this Mignola legacy. And that's not to knock Mike Mignola, but the man is a very, very busy man. And most people by this point are aware that Mike Mignola will occasionally do the covers for these books. A lot of these books he'll write, but in terms of getting, you know, Mike Mignola art, you know, it's a little bit more hard pressed these days. So, you know, Dark Horse has said, we understand that we can try to bring in really good creators and maybe get people to read a book they haven't read before. So they got John Arcudi's kind of Dark Horse old school, but they got Alex Maleev to draw the first Hellboy BPRD 52, yeah. And they got Paolo Rivera to draw 53. And they're bringing in these fantastic people and getting people like me that find Hellboy otherwise to be like I said, just sort of this insurmountable huge amount of material to say, you know what, I don't even care. Who knows? Who cares if this is as standalone as they say it is? I'm still gonna try it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can only think of maybe like a handful of people that I've actually like tried out weird books from, and Marco Rudy again, or I should say Matt Kent leading me to Marco Rudy, which then led me to, you know, more Alish Kott that I was like, okay, Zero was good, but can he do anything else? And then it turns out he can. You know, it's a weird circle. And then of course you get those beautiful moments where two creators that you really love end up working together, which I think the internet is always crying out, why don't you two creators work together? And then when it actually happens, it's like your mind either explodes,
yeah,
or the book,
when it happens, I get really nervous. I'm, yeah, like, what have I done?
What if it's not good?
What
though?
If this That's is like bad. The worst? Oh yeah. What if these people turn out to not be friends?
I mean, that was my thing when, you know, Matt Kent started working on Rye with Clayton Crane, and I love Clayton Crane's work.
Clayton, yeah. Crane.
I've been following his stuff, or trying to follow his stuff, since I read X-Force a long time ago, like the really dark X-Men book that came out probably 4 or 5 years ago. And when those two came together, I was like, okay, I know Matt Kent, I know he's a really good writer, and then Clayton Crane's art is just astounding, and it works so well for the Rye story that I was like, I was really worried that it wasn't going to be good, because who knows? Like, I had never read Rye before. I had no real major interest outside of, this guy looks cool, he's a robot in the year 4000, okay, count me in. And I mean, he's not really a robot, but that's getting into semantics.
Let's discuss what Rye's, yeah, know.
So that, but I mean, that book just blew me away, and I was really bummed when it ended, but now I'm like hooked on this 4001 AD train. I don't know how I'm going to get off. Like, my wallet is going to be empty by the end of the next 2 months. This summer is going to kill me with that storyline. So this is my own damn fault for liking comic books.
No, it's a good point, because like, especially with the whole Rye thing, like, if you follow creators far enough, like, some people I think are buying into this whole 4001 AD thing just because they really like what Matt Kent or Clayton Crane are doing with what they did with Rye, and so now all of a sudden these people are opening their wallets to this. It's not a huge event, but it's a big event, and it really, that's a testament to the strength of following these people and the allegiance that people develop over this.
Thanks for listening to the I Read Comic Books podcast. Our host and producer is Mike Rappin, and the show is edited by Xander Riggs. This week's music was brought to you by Flamingosis and Infinity Shred. You can find more of Flamingosis on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/flamingosis. And you can find more of Infinity Shred on Bandcamp at infinityshred.bandcamp.com. Wherever you look for new podcasts, don't forget to hit up the Potter and Family hashtag on Twitter. It's got tons of creators and their podcast creations, so check out the hashtag and support small podcasts like us. You can find more of this podcast at our website, ircb.us, or through the podcatcher of your choice. And remember, if you enjoy this show, tell someone about it, rate us online, or write to us. Who are your favorite comic creators, regardless of the project they work on? Send us your hype at ircb@destroythesybe.org. The entire podcast team is on Twitter, and you can follow the show at ircbpodcast. You can also join our discussions on our subreddit at ireadcomicbooks.reddit.com. And again, from all of us here at the podcast, thank you for listening.
Planning on seeing that movie at some point, John, or is it not,
I think so,
like a huge priority, or, well, sort of when it happens, or?
So I didn't really want to go out and deal with a packed, crowded theater.
Oh, sure.
I think what I'll end up doing, yeah, is I'll probably either go and see it on like a matinee, like, you know, 3 o'clock some weekend.
Weekday, yeah.
Or even, weekday, no, yeah. Or I'll just wait till it comes out on DVD or video. Because it looks interesting, but I feel like there's also going to be a lot of like, you are my friend. No, he's my friend, but you're my friend, me. I don't know. I could be wrong, but that's the impression that I got from the...
You're not entirely wrong.
The few,
no.
Yeah, the few clips that I saw. So, and it looks like it'll... I mean, it's a Marvel movie, so it'll be good, or at least not bad. I've enjoyed everyone I've seen so far, and I don't think I've been disappointed with any of them. Quick check. No, I don't think so.
For me, I've never really... I think for me, the weakest link is the Thor movies. I just don't...
Thor 2, Curse of the Blood Elves that are space elves.
Oh, God. Yeah, Thor 2 was like... For me, that might be that or Iron Man 2 might be the weakest one. But Iron Man 2 at least has the suitcase armor, which for me is like... Wait, awesome.
Which one was Iron Man 2?
That was the one with Sam Rockwell and Mickey Rourke. Rourke plays that Russian dude who slashes Tony Stark's car in half during the race.
Yeah, Whiplash. He shows up for all of like 5 minutes and then he's just dealt with.
No, he's not.
He is not?
He works for Sam Rockwell's character from that point on.
That's right. I remember that. Yeah, yeah, okay.
You have my bird.
Oh my God.
This is not my bird. Nick White does accents. Yeah, that's right.
The rest of this episode is actually going to just be Nick doing impressions of Whiplash.
Mickey Rourke.